Welcome to Bull Market Thinking. I'm your host, Dakota Da Silva. With us here on the line is returning guest, Doug Casey, chairman of Casey Research. Doug, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Dakota. It's nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to have you here, Doug. This year, we've seen one crisis after another break out in the Mediterranean, in Egypt, the social explosions in Brazil. You've produced the amazing work, Crisis Investing, there, I believe it was 1979. So I'd like to ask your opinion here. We've been seeing what looks like a larger number of crises occurring these days. How has it affected your opinion and perspective as you travel around the world today?
Well, the best thing to do with the crisis, the Chinese symbol for a crisis, incidentally, is a combination of two other ideograms, the ideogram for danger and that one for opportunity. So I'd like to see the opportunity part of it. Like you mentioned Egypt. I was in Cyprus a couple of weeks ago to look at the Cypriot stock market and also real estate markets, because this is interesting. I think few people are aware of it, that the index for Cyprus from its peak in 2007 is down 98%. That's an incredible drop. I mean, it's almost unique in modern history for a market to be down 98% in the course of only 6 years. So we went there for a thorough analysis of the economy. And I think there's some stocks worth buying that we're going to recommend in this report we're coming out with. And after the gunfire dies down, we might do the same thing in Cairo, too, because I've been to Egypt a number of times over the years. And the place is a basket case. And it's hard for me to see how, unless there's a radical change in many ways, it's hard for me to see how that place is going to get better. But the stock market could be a bargain there, too. And seems like the only bargains, or let's say cheap stock markets, I'm not going to say they're bargains yet, are in the Muslim world today, because that's where most of the crisis is at the moment.
Yeah. Doug, I remember 10 years ago, roughly, and it was in the early 2000s, that I first heard one of your interviews for the first time. And it was just so exciting for me as a younger person. And I would search the internet for more, and I couldn't find any. And it was only every couple years that I would hear something from someone like you and maybe Mark Faber or Jim Rogers. And what's interesting is now we have 5 or 10 interviews a week from guys like that, for example. And, of course, no one has the same perspective as you, which is quite different. But when you just this gigantic amount of information is available basically to anybody in the world today, whether somebody in Uganda or somebody in the Philippines, does that change things from a speculation standpoint?
It does, actually, because in the days before the internet, it's questionable that I would have even known that the market in Cyprus was down 98%, because information simply didn't travel that fast. It wasn't available. You would have had to have gotten on an airplane and gone to the site based on a rumor that something was down that much in the old days. So the internet has actually changed things radically. So it's easy to find out the places that you should be looking at now. So it's a marvelous thing, but it goes beyond that, because as you just mentioned earlier, if you were interested in alternative or libertarian or unconventional analyses of situations, it was hard to find in the old days. There were a few publications, hard to find, and some books, not many in print, but the internet has allowed these concepts to spread like wildfire, and it is a cause for tremendous optimism. Because just as in the past, technology has always been the friend of the average guy, just like the printing press, the Gutenberg Revolution, was a liberator for the average guy, just as gunpowder was a liberator for the average guy. The printing press made knowledge available to everybody, as opposed to just the elite who kept it for themselves. And gunpowder made self-defense easy for everybody. I mean, you couldn't take on an armored knight before gunpowder. After gunpowder, he was a sitting duck. And the internet is in the same mold as those two technological revolutions. Now, there are some short-term downsides, dangerous ones, like what the NSA is doing, trying to capture all the information. But they're on the wrong side of history. So I'm quite optimistic for the long run. From a technological point of view.
Doug, you've spoken a lot in the past about speculative opportunities being politically caused distortions in markets. And so on the same vein of the same information being available to anyone in the world, does that create more competition for you? Being a speculator and looking for opportunity, are there essentially more bidders out there keeping prices higher?
That's an excellent observation. And from a strictly speculative point of view, yes, you're right looking at it that way. But on the other hand, I might not even find out about some opportunities if it wasn't for the spread of information. So it perhaps balances things. And frankly, from a philosophical point of view, I'm very happy for more people, as many people as possible, to be exposed to opportunities. So, yeah, you're right, but you got to look at the bright side, too.
Yeah. To further mention here, along the same vein, if you think back to your days in terms of the speculations that you've made, what was maybe one or two of the greatest speculations that you have encountered in your life that you were able to take part in?
Well, some of the best ones are the ones that got away from me, quite frankly. Like back during the war in Rhodesia, before it became Zimbabwe, I came really close to buying a fantastic castle, if you can believe that, on the Mozambique border. I could have bought that with everything. Really, it was all kinds of things. It had a 9-hole golf course and 50 acres of coffee, and it was a hotel, really beautiful and large. I could have bought the whole thing for $85,000. And that was, when was that? That was about 1978. And by 1985, it had sold for $13 million. I didn't do it because if I had bought it, I would have had to have lived there to defend it, or else it would have disassembled. But if I had changed my life and done that, it would have been a great hit. But so there are lots of things like that that come and go. I mean, one of the best hits that I ever made are in the market was actually a mining stock, which I do most of what I do on is mining stocks. And it was a fraud. Nobody knew it was a fraud. It was the biggest fraud in mining history, called Briex, because initially when they were announcing the results, wow, in Indonesia, these are fantastic sounding results. So you had to jump on, and the stock went from $1 to, my goodness, how high did it go? I've almost forgotten now, close to $200. So I was buying it simply because it had great results, and I bought a lot of it at $1. And I sold it, once again, not because I knew it was a fraud, but because its market cap was greater than that of Freeport-McMoRan, which had invested many billions in developing its deposits. So those were a couple of them that stand out in my mind as being big deals. But I'm always looking for opportunities. I mean, I've invested a lot in private companies over the years. They call it private capital today. And some of them go to zero. But when you get lucky, you get really lucky. So it's impossible to predict these things in advance. You know, sometimes it's the real oddballs that never seem like they're going to work out that work out the best. For instance, another mining example of that would be diamond fields. And that was luck, quite frankly. I bought into it based upon its diamond deposits in offshore Namibia. It turned out, by a total accident, it was a fluke, They found the biggest nickel, one of the biggest nickel deposits in the world in Labrador. Took the stock from 25 cents to a couple $100 again. So I don't know. There are many paths up the mountain, and there's no certainty in anything. If you want certainty, you've got to take the long-term view that Warren Buffett does. But he's not a speculator. He doesn't capitalize on politically caused distortions in the market. What he does, quite intelligently, you can't argue with his immense success, is buying growth companies with good management and hold them for the long term. But, you know, that's a different method of investing. It's not what I do, although I approve of it. I approve of it totally. But, you know, you've got to play to your own personal strong suits.
Yeah. Doug, I've heard you mention in the past, and you've told this to me in a previous interview, that you need to have a reserve of capital with which to do things. You said once that that there is great opportunity for a young person who takes $10,000, goes into China, and walks out of the country 20 years later after some hard work and focus and so forth. Was it a kicking, a scratching, clawing your way up in terms of your beginnings of building your first stashes of capital and applying that to the speculations that you found?
Well, I've got to say that I've been very lucky throughout my life, and I don't think you can underplay the importance of just luck, being in the right place at the right time, perhaps. For instance, I got into the mining area, which is, I do lots of things, but I'm in lots of areas because I read broadly, I look at everything. But I got into the mining business because I wanted to be a geologist when I was a little kid. After I wanted to be a paleontologist and an archaeologist, I wanted to be a geologist. So I was always interested in minerals and that type of thing. And then as I got more interested in money, I started reading books, and fortunately, I came across Henry Hazlitt's Small Work of Genius, which I want to recommend now to everybody listening. It's Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. It's a minor work of genius, important to read. Then I read Harry Brown's You Can Profit from the Coming Devaluation, which correctly predicted, and for the right reasons, the 1971 devaluation. I put two and two together. I bought mining stocks, and there was a huge bull market for mining stocks in the 70s. I made a lot of money on those things. So, you know, that's how I got my original capital put together. And then, of course, I wrote a couple books, and they were huge bestsellers, and the publishers gave me a lot of money for those, and that helped to supercharge my career. And I bought bonds in the early 80s when they were yielding 12-13%. That helped. So, you know, these things compound on one or another if you're lucky and if you have good judgment. But you'll get more lucky and you'll have better judgment if you read a lot of stuff and you keep your eyes open and ask questions. And I've always done all of those things.
Doug, what does your gut say about the fabric of the world when you look at bonds now, when you look at interest rates now? Because collapse there or a major long-term bear market would have, I would think, huge implications, right? Not just in the economic, but the financial or in the social, cultural aspects maybe too?
Oh, yeah. I agree. I think that right now, as we speak, we're still in the midst of the biggest bubble in world history. It's bigger than the tech stock market bubble of around the turn of the century. It's bigger than the real estate bubble, too. But the bond bubble, with interest rates ranging from zero to a few percent, this is the biggest bubble in history. And when it collapses, it's going to be catastrophic because the bond market is so huge. It's much bigger than the stock market is. So interest rates, when they head back up, and they will, if only as a result of inflation, as a result of fear of companies not being able to pay back. This is going to be huge. It's going to be huge. It's going to result in lots of financial companies collapsing. I mean, I pity the poor person that is saving in a currency because the governments are going to continue printing up money. Now, this is very complex, very big, very serious. So I guess my bottom line would be hold on to your hat, because for the next 10 years, from every point of view I can imagine, economic, financial, social, military, are going to be extraordinarily tumultuous. I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah. If I can also ask you, Doug, about the decline of the American empire, declining political and economic influence, has the progression of that been slower? Has it taken a lot longer than what maybe you have expected in earlier years?
Well, you know, I think it was it Milton Friedman who was repeating what Adam Smith said, which is there's a lot of ruin in a country, and it takes a long time for systems to wind down. It takes a long time for the capital accumulated over generations to be dissipated in stupidity. But it always happens, just because of the second law of thermodynamics, which basically says that all systems degrade. And the more complex the system, the more certain it is to degrade. So, yes, it's perhaps looking at it from the point of view of just my lifetime, it's taken longer than you might think. But just because something's inevitable doesn't necessarily mean it's imminent. But it's accelerating. The trend is accelerating at this point. So I think we're pretty close to the edge of the precipice. But anything could have happened. Anything could have happened, really, to the world economy since the 1970s. But they've managed to build the house of cards higher yet. But it's fascinating to watch. But I can't be optimistic about the next few years. They're going to be, I think, quite chaotic. But that doesn't mean the world's going to come to an end. It just means it's going to be reorganized.
Doug, to ask you here about precious metals and mining stocks, when you look back at your career, has there been any other time where there's been a similar set or a matching set of circumstances in terms of how beat up the sector is with, I guess, all other things being equal?
Yeah, there have been a number of times when they've been this cheap. They were this cheap in about 2001. They were this cheap back in 1982. They were this cheap back in 1971. But mining is a tough business, and it's really not a very good business. I always describe it as a 19th century choo-choo train type of business. It's about the polar opposite of the semiconductor and high-tech and biotech businesses. And it's very politically unpopular and incorrect as well. But all that being said, these mining stocks, the good ones, the well-managed ones, are really about as cheap as they've been in history. So unless you think people are going to stop wanting or needing copper and nickel and uranium and gold and silver and moly, you've got to buy these things now. They're really about as cheap as they've ever been, although they've been this cheap a number of times in the last 40-some years that I've been watching them. Yeah, I mean, that is a place that anybody listening, if they're looking for something cheap, and there's not much cheap in the world today, everything, oddly, to me, seems rather overpriced, except for these stocks, which have really been beaten down.
Yeah. So, Doug, what would you say is the best strategy for people who want to begin preparing, are not sure exactly what to buy, may not know which mining stocks or what have you, but want to prepare not just financially but intellectually for these changes that you're talking about? Are there a certain handful of books that they need to have in their library to prepare? Should they begin putting their capital on a monthly basis into something to get ready? What would you recommend?
Well, look, your savings, it's just capital you're putting aside to look for future opportunities. That should be in the form of precious metals, the physicals, and everybody should buy some of those every month. I still do. If you want to speculate, these mining stocks, as we speak, are good. They're burning matches. They're not long-term holdings, but now they're good. If you really want to speculate, you can go into the futures markets. I would say short Japanese bonds. That would probably be the best single thing I could think of. But more important than these particular recommendations at the moment are arming yourself with knowledge. Now, I recommended a couple of books, in particular Economics in One Lesson. If you don't mind, I'd recommend my books, including the most recent one, which is called Totally Incorrect, that I think is actually quite good. If you want the best book on the stock market out there, it's a classic. It's the one that Warren Buffett has planned his whole investment career around. It's called The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham. Very important to read. Another book I'd recommend highly, 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 is The Market for Liberty by Tannehill. And that one's free on the internet. So that's a good list to start. I mean, that'll keep people busy for a few months.
Okay. Well, Doug Casey, chairman of Casey Research, thank you so much for sharing your comments with us again.
Well, nice to be here with you, Chico.